Professor Odegaard.
I've said that the Congress of the United States is not only a representative assembly, not only a legislative body, but is the main deliberative assembly of the American people. Visitors to the galleries of Congress, especially to the House of Representatives, will usually be disappointed to discover that the chamber is probably empty or a very few scattered colleagues on the floor, all of whom seem to display a monumental indifference to the person who may be speaking at the time. They read newspapers, they carry on conversation without much regard for what he says or who he is. And if the visitor listens to the speaker, he may be equally disappointed in the quality of what he hears. Nor will he be very much reassured if he goes from the gallery, having heard the discussion, to the congressional record to read the records there. But if he knows what he wants to hear, and if he wants to read about a particular bill or a particular piece of legislation, and is willing to spend the time necessary, he can hear and he can read learned and able discussion, if not eloquent discussion. He may have to pursue his interest in committee hearings or plow through technical reports prepared for members of Congress or the committees, and he may have to pick the day for attendance in the gallery when the subject in which he is interested is up for debate and discussion. Because I think the hope of the framers that the legislative process could have a large measure of rationality to it has not been by any means wholly disappointed. Indeed, I think one can argue that the decline in the great oratory of the past has in a very real measure improved the quality of deliberation and debate. Daniel Webster, standing in the floor of the Senate, delivering his great 7th of March speech in March 1850, with the Senate chamber crowded incidentally with women, so that the senators themselves couldn't get to their own seats. This sort of thing is not the kind of incident that you will encounter very frequently in Washington these days. And I'm not so sure that the loss of this kind of oratory is altogether a bad thing, because oratory of this kind can inspire hate and conflict as much as it can inspire hope and unity. Everyone knows to what bitter ends bitter words can lead. Let me give you an illustration from a great discussion that took place in the Senate of the United States in May 1856. I take May 19th, 1856 as the day because on this day, 800 armed men had marched into Lawrence, Kansas in a battle over slavery that came to be known as the Struggle of Bloody Kansas. On that day, Charles Sumner of Massachusetts rose to speak to a crowded Senate chamber. Sumner was a tall man, 6 feet 4 inches. His presence, the vigor and grace of his oratory, always commanded attention. On this day, he wore a light sack suit with white trousers. According to the reports, his linen was immaculate, his hair carefully oiled and curled. But however pleasing his appearance, and however dulcet his voice, he was a fountainhead of hate. Even his northern colleagues described his performance at this time as cowardly, mean, malignant, and hypocritical. He spoke easily and without notes, but his language was vitriolic, vulgar, and even obscene. The attack on Kansas, he said, was, and I quote him, the rape of a virgin territory, compelling it to the hateful embrace of slavery. And as for those people, he said, who defended slavery, they were without honor of any kind. No defender of slavery, he said, could be a gentleman. Now, among the senators, but absent on this occasion, was Andrew Pickens Butler of South Carolina. Butler was an aged man, and ailing, but he was highly respected by his colleagues. A partial paralysis of his lips made it difficult for him to speak, even had he been present, which he was not. And it was on the absent and the helpless Butler that Sumner heaped his worst abuse. Senator Butler, he said, prided himself on being a knight. And as a knight, he had chosen to serve a mistress who, though ugly to everyone else, was yet beautiful to him. I mean, said Sumner, the harlot slavery. Butler's defense of this strumpet, said Sumner, surpassed the frenzy of Don Quixote in behalf of his Dulcinea. And if Butler was the knight, so Stephen Douglas, senator from Illinois, was the squire of slavery. Its very Sancho Panza, ready to do all its most humiliating offices. Referring to what he called the loose expectoration of Senator Butler's speech in defense of South Carolina, Sumner then proceeded to turn his guns on that state. South Carolina's whole history, he said, could be blotted out, and civilization would lose less than it has already gained by the example of bleeding Kansas. As this went on to become more violent and more vulgar, Senator Stephen Douglas, who was standing in the back of the chamber, paced the floor and said to a friend, "That damn fool will get himself killed by some other damn fool." And when Sumner finished, Douglas rose not to reply, but to reprove him for what another senator called the most un-American speech that has ever grated on the ears of this high body. Sumner's speech, said Douglas, might have been excused had it been delivered in the heat of debate. But, he said, Sumner had his speech written, had it printed, had committed it to memory. He'd practiced every night before the glass with a Negro boy to hold the candle and watch his gestures, and annoyed the boarders so much in the adjoining rooms that they actually had to leave the house. No, said Douglas, this speech has been written with cold, deliberate malignity. And then he came here to spit forth that malignity upon men who differ from him. To all this, Sumner replied, saying, "No person with the upright form of man can be allowed to switch out from his tongue this perpetual stench of offensive personality. The noisome, squat, and nameless animal to which I now refer is not a proper model for an American senator. I hope the senator from Illinois will take notice." "I will," retorted Douglas, "and therefore will not imitate you, sir." And sitting in the balcony on that day was a young congressman from South Carolina named Preston Brooks. He was a tall man, robust, overgrown, and a relative of Senator Butler, both of whom were fanatic South Carolinians. 2 days after Sumner's speech, Brooks strode into the Senate chamber with a friend. The Senate was not in session, but Sumner was at his desk writing. Brooks walked up to him and said, according to the reports, "Sir," he said, "I have read your speech with great care and with as much impartiality as I could. I feel it my duty to say to you that you have published a libel on my state and uttered a slander upon a relative who is aged and absent, and I have therefore come to punish you." Whereupon he beat Sumner over the head and shoulders with a heavy gutta-percha cane until the cane broke into pieces. Sumner, who was a huge man, tried to rise from his seat, was unable to get out of the seat, and in rising tore the seat actually from the floor. Under the incessant blows from Brooks, Sumner fell back into his seat, where he was beaten into insensibility, and, as you know, was paralyzed for the rest of his life. Now, the attack by Brooks set the North aflame. It was cited as typical of slave owners everywhere, particularly when from all over the South, Southerners began sending gutta-percha canes to members of Congress. It proved that Southerners were brutes and bullies to the North. This brutal, murderous, and cowardly assault, as it was described by Senator Wilson, became an assault not on Sumner, but on the whole North as well. And the whole incident was another signpost on the road to civil war. It was but one of many incidents of this kind during this early period of grand oratory. The language of vilification and insult bore fruit in violence and war. Now, I don't say that this kind of oratory caused the war, only that it helped to make the war inevitable. And if I may add, by way of a footnote, I would suggest that one of the great needs of the world today is a moratorium on this kind of vituperation. Now, by contrast, with this sort of thing, the speech by the late Senator George Norris on the Tennessee Valley Authority, or a speech by the late Brian McMahon arguing for civilian control of atomic energy, all of this may sound very dull and unexciting, but in my judgment, it adds more light to what is being considered than the kind of thing that happened so often in the days of the grand orators. And I'm not so sure that I wouldn't rather have speeches that shed more light and fewer speeches that generate so much heat. Now, when you move from the Senate to the House of Representatives, you find that debate is severely limited. The very size of the House and the nature of its organization and procedure makes some limitation on debate essential. A House of Representatives in which debate was unlimited would require radical change in size, in function, and in its organization. As matters stand in the House, there are no less than 30 different motions or questions on which no debate is permitted at all. No member can speak more than an hour, even on those motions that are open to debate. If he wants to speak more than an hour, he must get the unanimous consent of the House. Most debate on amendments in the House of Representatives is limited to 5 minutes. Now, occasionally you can get a suspension of the rules, as it's called. But even when you have a suspension of the rules, you can debate an amendment for no more than 40 minutes. No member can speak more than twice on the same subject without special permission. And discussion in the House must always be relevant. It must be on the subject that is on the agenda, that is under discussion, except occasionally when the House is in what is known as the Committee of the Whole on the State of the Union. And of course, in order to speak in the House of Representatives, it's tall. You have to get the eye of the speaker. And the speaker, let me assure you, has a very discriminating are. And even in the debate in the Committee of the Whole House, debate can be limited in the House of Representatives under a special rule reported by the Rules Committee. And since most important legislation is considered under a special rule from the Rules Committee, debate is very severely limited. It's the Senate that provides the great forum for debate in our system. The basic rule governing debate in the Senate imposes no limitation at all upon the length of debate, upon the number of times people can speak. Moreover, discussion in the Senate does not have to be relevant. It doesn't have to be germane, as they say, to the question at issue. Because senators are very fond of speaking, some device had to be devised to get any work done. And so the device that the Senate uses is to fix in advance, by unanimous consent, a time, day and time, when the Senate will take a vote. And when that day and time comes, debate is automatically cut off. This procedure, known in the British House of Commons as the guillotine, because it chops off debate, makes it possible to curb the more garrulous members of the Senate and get a decision on pending legislation. Now, unlimited debate in the Senate leads to the use of a parliamentary device called the filibuster, by which opponents of a bill or a motion on the floor can delay it and hopefully kill it by preventing the issue from coming to a vote. Now, let me emphasize that the filibuster is a device used by the minority to delay or to defeat a bill that the minority is confident the majority will support if they can only get a chance to vote at it. Now, it's the most effective, the filibuster is most effective toward the end of a congressional term or toward the end of a congressional session, when senators are very anxious to get home for a rest and for general repairs to their political fences. But it can be used at other times. Now, there have been many historic filibusters. We can't describe them here. A couple illustrations. During the closing days of the 64th Congress, ending March 4th, 1917, a proposal that came from the White House, from President Wilson, was before the Senate. It was a proposal to authorize the arming of American merchant ships against German submarines. There were a group of senators bitterly opposed to this because they felt that Wilson had just been reelected on a slogan, "He kept us out of war," and that now he was taking us on the road to the war. And so they proposed to kill this proposal for arming merchantmen by talking it to death. And 12 of them organized a filibuster that went on day after day after day until finally Congress adjourned and the proposition died. Wilson was very bitter about this and referred to Senator La Follette, who was the leader of this group, and his colleagues as a body of willful 12, or the willful 12 who put their own political interests ahead of the safety of the country. As a matter of fact, you know, Wilson went ahead and armed the merchantmen anyway under his powers as president. Senator Wayne Morris, to take another one, Senator Wayne Morris spoke for 22 hours and 26 minutes. I think that's pretty near a record. On April 24th, 1953, as one of a group of senators who were opposed to the federal government turning the rich offshore oil resources over to a few states. Senator Paul Douglas spoke for 3 days against this bill. And in 1956, Senator Douglas spoke 4 days against a bill to relieve natural gas companies of regulation by the Federal Power Commission. In recent years, I mean recent years since 1954, the filibuster has been used mainly by Southerners who want to delay and defeat in this way civil rights legislation. Now, you'll see from these illustrations that opposition to the filibuster has alternated between conservatives and liberals. Conservatives were indignant at La Follette in 1917, and at Wayne Morris, and at Paul Douglas, and so on. But now, because they used the filibuster, but now the shoe is on the other foot. And the liberals are objecting to the use of filibuster, and the conservatives are defending. There's been a demand for some kind of check on the filibuster, some kind of limitation upon debate in the Senate for a long time. Finally, in 1917, a Rule 22 was adopted by the Senate, which provides what is known as cloture, C-L-O-S-U-R-E, or if you want to be fancy, C-L-O-T-U-R-E. This rule provides that on the motion of 16 senators, plus a two-thirds vote of senators present and voting, debate can be brought to an end. This system of cloture is the system that now prevails. And there's a current demand for a much more liberal cloture rule. They point out that between 1917 and 1960, 23 cloture petitions have been filed in the Senate. And of the 23 cloture petitions filed, 4 have been approved. And not one has been approved since 1927. And so there is a great demand now for a liberalization of the cloture rule that will permit some mitigation of the use of this device, the filibuster, in defeating or delaying legislation. Now, the arguments for the filibuster go back as far at least as Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, who agreed, incidentally, on this subject. Jefferson, who wrote the manual of parliamentary procedure, which is still the manual for the United States Senate, says on this, "The rules of the Senate, which allow full freedom of debate, are designed for protection of the minority. And this design is part of the warp and woof of our Constitution. You cannot remove it without damaging the whole fabric." And Hamilton, who agreed with Jefferson on this, "There are particular moments," he said, "in public affairs when the people, stimulated by some passion or artful misrepresentation, may call for measures which they themselves will afterward be most ready to lament and to condemn. In these critical moments," he said, "how salutary it is if the interference of some temperate and respectable body of men can be interposed until reason, justice, and truth can regain their authority over the public mind." Anyway, say the friends of the filibuster, the Senate can and does, by unanimous consent, adopt what I explained before, the guillotine, to close debate by agreeing in advance to vote at a particular time. And besides, they point out, there is nothing to indicate that the Senate is any less efficient, on the whole, than the House of Representatives in getting through its share of the legislative load. And they point out that a free, untrammeled forum is indispensable in a responsible representative republic. Now, the people who want some more liberal closure rule, want it easier to close off debate, argue a little different. They say, to have a more liberal closure rule will not interfere with free and full debate, because all of the proposals that have been made would leave ample room for debate even after closure is imposed. Closure, they say, is absolutely essential and increasingly essential if the Senate is to get its work done, and that the filibuster now permits a minority to thwart the will of the majority. As Senator Morse, who himself has engaged in a number of filibusters, says, under the filibuster, with all its insidious effrontery, the principle of rule by majority is denied the people in the determination of congressional policy. I do not say that the majority is always right, but I do say that under our form of government, a minority of senators should not be permitted by means of the filibuster to block legislation favored by the majority. And at this point, the issue now stands, and next time I should like to turn to the Congress of the United States at work in its committees.
Successful completion of the first semester is not a prerequisite for second semester enrollment, and those interested in taking the course for credit should address inquiries to National Coordinator, Continental Classroom, Box 1776, New York 19, New York. A textbook entitled American Government, Structure, Problems, and Policies has been expressly prepared for the second semester by Dr. Odegaard, Hans Bearwald, and others, and costs $4. A book of documents and readings edited by Odegaard and Rosenblum, which costs $2.50, and a study guide prepared by Dr. Odegaard, which costs $1, are also available. The text, book of readings, and study guide may be obtained from your local bookstore, or all three books may be obtained by sending a check or money order for $7.50 to Roe, Peterson & Company, Evanston, Illinois. This program has been made possible through the cooperation of Olin, the Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing Company, the Radio Corporation of America in association with the NBC Television Network.